I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's Flag Day. Do you know why? All right, I'll tell you. On this day, June 14th in 1777, the U.S. Congress announced that the flag of the 13 United States be 13 strips, alternate red and white, that the Union be 13 stars, white in a field of blue, representing a new constellation. During the Revolution, the flag had become a symbol for independence, unencumbered by religious emblem or autocratic heraldry. It was a symbol of government for and by the people. Today, on the anniversary of the flag's official birth, you won't hear a politician making speeches about it or department stores organizing sales around it, but you won't have far to go to find one. Old Glory now adorns everything from car lots and gas stations to shopping malls and liquor stores and front porches, too, since the country is involved in a multitude of conflicts. So, Connection listeners, here's our question. What does the flag mean to you? And what does the sheer number of flags and their placement tell us about how the meaning of this symbol has changed? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, the number to call to join in the conversation. And I'm joined now by Whitney Smith, who is director of the Flag Research Center in Winchester, Massachusetts. Dr. Smith is the author of 26 different books on flags and editor of the Flag Bulletin, the International Journal of Vexillology. So first, vexillology, it's the study of flags?
Exactly.
And is this a well-known term or a recent term?
It's a neologism. It's actually something that I coined because I was doing it. I was studying flags as a teenager, and there wasn't any word. And that word comes from the Latin vexillum, meaning flag, and ology, study of. It is now in the Oxford English Dictionary and the Unabridged Webster's and so forth. And it's also used in other countries in their own languages.
When did you become so interested in flags?
I can date it most precisely. I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts, where the first Battle of the Revolution took place. And my dad took me to Patriots Day on April 19th and bought me a little flag, which I still have. And the common in Lexington had the state flags, and you didn't see collections of flags in that era. So it was very exciting, and that's how it started.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, I was just reading from the proclamation of 1777, the Continental Congress, proclaiming the design of the flag as Betsy Ross designed it. But do you know what the Minutemen fought under? Did they have a flag, a pennant that they fought under?
Well, a couple of things here. First of all, Betsy Ross did not design the flag.
I knew you would say that. I knew you would say that.
We don't need to get into that. If you did want a flag designed, you would come to someone like me who is a professional in the field. But in those days, it didn't exist. The Minutemen were called out, of course, on a minute's notice for the British marching into the hinterlands. And they didn't, so far as we know, carry flags, except that there's one in Bedford that presumably was used, and there's one that has been in private hands, is now in the hands of a foundation that was also used.
So what was the design of that flag?
Well, the Bedford one was an old cavalry flag. It was already 100 years old, and they just brought it out again to use. The other one had the Union Jack in the corner because we had been good, loyal subjects. And then they later changed that to stripes, and that flag is the oldest known one with red and white stripes.
So there were red and white stripes, and the Union Jack, Jack, I'll get emails from Britain. The Union Jack is no longer with it.
It was in the flag originally. It was a red flag with a Union Jack in the corner. And after
Lexington and the stripes?
And Concord, and there were no stripes. And then after that, they literally cut it out and replaced it with the red and white stripes. It was a very formal statement. We don't consider ourselves British anymore.
And they used the flag to make that statement along with their guns. Now, flags have been a part of the expression of national identity, group identity, almost from the beginnings of group identity before written history.
Absolutely. In fact, not just of nationalism, which is relatively new, but we have flags that date back. There's one from Iran, for example, that is 5,000 years old. And we know of others in India, in Egypt, and elsewhere. people want to express their personal identity and their collective identity. We're the good guys. You people are the enemies, the rebels, the outcasts.
Right. Now, you've written that tattoos may have actually been the first form of flag.
We know, for example, the Ötzi, the Iceman that was found in the Alps, that people were using that as early as 10, 20,000 years ago, and it was a way of self-identification and group identification, just as flags are today. It's just another manifestation of this impulse.
Now, the American love of flag in my lifetime has gone from something as simple as being a schoolboy and reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in that kind of automatic rote sensibility that you have when you've crept like a snail unwillingly to school and you have to stand up and do it. It has become a symbol of a kind of America that people didn't want. It's been burned. Now, of course, it's become a different kind of symbol. How do Americans respond to the flag? Is it vastly different than the way other nationalities respond to their flag?
It's more a question of degree, but we started out as a country without a royal dynasty, without an aristocracy, without a state religion, without a common basis of life other than that we happened to be former British subjects. So the flag gradually took the place of all those other symbols in other countries. And our greatest surge in flag attention came during the Civil War when the Stars and Stripes was fired on at Fort Sumter in 1861. And it's been onward and upward ever since.
And just to say, listeners, just before we came on air, some wire service copy moved. You may recall that there was the Supreme Court had been called on to adjudicate whether the phrase "under God" could remain in the Pledge of Allegiance, and it has dismissed that case on a technicality and ruled that California atheist Michael Newdow, who brought the suit, lacked the legal right to bring the challenge in the first place, and so children will continue to recite the Pledge of Allegiance as I recited it, as probably most of you recited it, one nation under God. And that's just a bit of news that's come out on Flag Day. And I'd like to bring into the conversation now Carolyn Marvin, who's professor of communications at the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Good morning, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Now, you're in Philadelphia. You know that what Whitney Smith just said about Betsy Ross is going to hurt down there.
Well, of course. But, you know, these are ongoing debates that we have about the flag. They've been present ever since the Civil War, and these kinds of issues about exactly what is the appropriate treatment of the flag and what really should it mean and does it symbolize the right things and is a particular behavior with the flag something that we approve of or reject are not recent controversies, but they're ongoing.
Ongoing.
They're really conversations about what kind of a community we are.
Well, go back a little further. I alluded to the Vietnam era and when flag waving and flag burning both became statements. What have been some of the other controversies surrounding the flag over the centuries?
Well, the civil rights movement used the flag quite a lot, and the people that were in favor of civil rights for African Americans allied themselves to the flag quite proudly to say we're Americans and we African Americans deserve the same rights as all Americans. And, of course, in previous wars, the flag has always been something that people rallied to, but then on the other hand, when the strikes and labor movements and the gradual acceptance of labor unions was accompanied by those people that wanted to organize also connecting themselves to the flag. It's always a way of saying our cause is just and this is what the country should be.
So our cause it is just is a phrase in one of the more forgotten verses of the Star-Spangled Banner, which is,
right,
of course, it's our national anthem, and it is about the pride that Francis Scott Key felt as he was rowing across Baltimore Harbor and saw the flag still standing on Fort McHenry, right?
Well, that's right. And, you know, the flag, as everybody knows at some level, is only a piece of cloth. And so the meaning that it has is that set of things that we associate with it. And what's important about the Francis Scott Key Association, and indeed all our flag liturgy, and is that our most important associations with the flags are in terms of sacrifice for the country and death for the country. I mean, this really, you had alluded in your introduction to the fact that there is a kind of religious character to the flag, and I think that religious model goes a long way towards explaining a lot of things about the flag, what it means to us, because when you take the flag and constantly associate it with death for the country, I mean, the Reagan funeral was full of this idea, then you are creating a certain basic meaning of the flag that gives people this kind of great investment in it as a sacred object.
We're talking about sacred, but I mean, let's be clear, it is a martial object. Sometimes seems to be a martial object first and foremost, Whitney.
One of the things you have to keep in mind is we look at the flag and we, quote, know what it means. As a matter of fact, we put that meaning in through our ceremonies, through what we learn in school. The cloth, in a sense, means nothing at all. And we can change over time. As Wilson said, and I'm paraphrasing, this flag belongs to all of us, and each generation defines what it means. It's not permanent. We think of it that way.
But the point I was just making about, it's religious and sacred, and we speak of ultimate sacrifice. But in the history of flags, in vexillology, the martial use of the standard, isn't it almost the foremost use, Whitney?
Absolutely. You find in the earliest societies that the kings and the priests allied themselves and the military leaders to control the society, and a flag representing the powers of the universe, and particularly of the heavens, was an important function in that, and that was drilled into them, and in a sense it still is.
Carolyn, today the flag is, you know, you were just mentioning Ronald Reagan's funeral, and of course there was the controversy over the flag-draped coffin photos, which the military was trying to suppress but ultimately mm-hmm. came out. But in our society, it's also become an extraordinarily commercial symbol as well.
It's been a commercial symbol for a long time, not just recently. But can I return to your point about its being entirely a martial flag first? Because I think that's true, but the reason that that's important is because of its association with death. I mean, the greatest power that a leader has or a country has is the power to deal death, to ask its own citizens to die and to kill enemies. And that is the greatest power that God has as well for religious people, is that ability to control life and death. But there's also a derivative meaning. I mean, in the same way that great power is to deal death, another power is to create life. And we have a version of the flag. It's not the one we normally think about, but we have a version of the flag that could properly be described as a fertility flag, is associated with fertility. And this is the flag that you often see in presidential campaigns, in logos, and where you take the elements of the original flag, the elements that all native cultural speakers, so to speak, know belong to the flag, and then you rearrange them. You turn them into presidential logos. You turn them into bunting. You turn them into clothing that refers to the flag and all this kind of stuff. And this is the community remaking itself. This is the fertile community. And that is a very systematic representation of the flag, and it's very commercial often as well.
We're coming up to the break, listeners. We're talking about the flag. It's Flag Day. And after the break, we'll be taking your calls. What does the American flag mean to you today? Is it the same as it meant to you 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in our flag conversation. Don't let it flag this conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour, listeners, about the flag. It's Flag Day. Not just the American flag. We're talking about flags throughout history, what they mean. There are almost some religious significance in almost every society. In this hour, I'm joined by Whitney Smith, who's director of the Flag Research Center in Winchester, Massachusetts, and Carolyn Marvin, professor of communications at the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Scott is calling from West Columbia, South Carolina.
How y'all doing this morning?
Good.
Okay, what the flag means to me, like I was telling the lady who answered the phone, every morning I get up with the aches and the pains from my years of service, sacrificing my body, possibly my life, for that flag. I'm in the South Carolina State Guard. I'm a sergeant first class, and we are in – I work at a alternative school for kids, and it's military-based through the National Guard. And every morning we rise the flag up, every morning or every evening we send it down. And we let them know it's because of that flag, because of what the flag stands for, that you got a second chance. And, I mean, I sacrificed anything for that flag, and I about sacrificed everything for that flag over the years.
And do you teach them flag etiquette about not touching the ground, the way to fold it real tight?
Absolutely. No red showing whatsoever. The whole nine yards. Not to move. I don't care if you got a bee stinging your behind. You don't move until you're told to move.
Right. And do the kids get it in a rotation? Are they given the flag, particularly taking the flag down in the evening? Is that a reward for doing well during the day, or is it just a regular rotation?
Actually, what it is, it is a detail. Everybody has to do it, and everybody does it multiple times. It's a 22-week cycle, so everybody gets to do it, and they understand. And you got some who you can tell the flag means more to because the flag is always tighter, and they actually care because they do understand. You know, people sacrifice their lives, their health, their bodies, their families. They sacrificed everything for that flag so they could have the rights and privileges that they have now.
Scott, stay with us for a second. Whitney, the origins of this flag etiquette and the exactly precise way to fold it up at the end of the day, where does that come from?
It goes back to the beginning of the 20th century, and there were attempts of Pledge of Allegiance, for example, in the 19th century. But after the First World War in particular, private organizations drafted a flag code. Came the Second World War. People wanted that ratified by Congress. But one of the – what I think is the wonderful thing about flag etiquette is that there are no penalties attached to the flag code. And, in fact, even a direct infraction of it is not illegal, which is one way of saying the flag belongs to all of us, even those who have extremist views of right or left of one kind or another. They, too, are part of that flag. It's not just a certain percentage of the population.
Okay. Scott, I just want to ask you a little question here, slightly mischievous. You're from South Carolina.
Yes, there
was a flag controversy in South Carolina recently. Well, not that recently, over the last few years, about the Confederate flag, the stars and bars hanging up there on the State House. Where do you come down in that one?
Well, I'm actually from the North. I was military. Really, it did not concern me. That was for the people of South Carolina to choose. This is their state. I'm an outsider just living here.
All right.
That's kind of neutral, and I can sidestep the question that way. Because
do you get asked that question much?
Yes, actually I do. I got asked that question a lot, especially big time during the controversy. And it's like this: I've got black friends, I got white friends, I got all kind of friends. I would not disrespect, say, you know, yeah, keep it up there. We'll have my black friends hate me, or go ahead, take it down, have my white friends. You know, hey, you know, everybody can take a flag, hold it for their own personal view. You got militia groups out west. Hmm. Doing their thing, saying flag, 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 but breaking as many laws as humanly possible. But
right. Okay, Scott, I want to thank you for your call. Carolyn, now that controversy, this gets at the core of the standard, which one is engraved on one's heart.
Yes, exactly. But it helps you understand that a loyalty to flag is not about victory. It's about sacrifice. That's what's most important to him about that, and that's what it means. And in the case of the Confederate flag controversy, what you've got is two competing sacrifices. Southerners arguing that their sacrifice was not properly acknowledged or needed to be properly acknowledged, and African Americans saying our sacrifice takes precedence. So you had two groups, both of whom felt that they had not had victories not just felt, but I mean, both of them had not had victories in various ways. But the argument they're making is our sacrifice is meaningful and deserves to be recognized. And the whole thing about the American flag, too, is that it was, in fact, the gradual participation of Southerners in World War I and World War II that helped them see themselves as patriotic citizens and participants in the country.
It's interesting. I was in Mississippi some years ago and speaking to someone not far from Jefferson Davis's birthplace, and he said that it was World War II that actually made Mississippians feel that they were finally part of the United States again, roughly 80 years after the end of the Civil War, and could respect and respond to those symbols, and they took them on with the same avid nature with which they once took on the symbols of the Confederacy.
That's right. I mean, sacrifice is a very unifying device when we feel that we share it. For example, in the first Gulf War, President Bush, then President Bush Sr., made a repeated argument that the whole point of this first Gulf War is that all of the difficulties and controversies of the 60s and of Vietnam, they're all behind us now, and that's what this flag means with its yellow ribbon and that kind of thing. And so the sacrifice always provides a way to put aside the other petty arguments and come together.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Lib is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hi. I like this conversation. It's something I've been thinking about for a while. Of course, the flag that we have is the only flag I've ever known. I'm a 71-year-old semi-retired black teacher, and I can remember having problems saying the Pledge of Allegiance before they inserted the word under God, because I didn't believe that it's one nation without that phrase. I know the phrase wasn't put in for the reason that I use it, but
that's really, really interesting. In other words, as an African American, you felt slightly excluded, that the flag didn't represent you, but the introduction of God's name actually seemed to make it more inclusive than for you.
Yes, but at the same time today, I really am questioning whether that should be there, because we have atheists and we have other people who don't believe in God, you know, and if it's that their flag, they should be able to say it too. So that's why I say I have mixed emotions.
Whitney Smith.
One of the things in the presidential proclamation for the recent death of President Reagan called on Americans on the day of mourning to go to their respective houses of worship for this. And I thought it was very interesting because implicitly the 10-20% of Americans who are atheists or agnostics or just not church members implicitly were excluded. And I think that's part of why this whole question of those two words went to the Supreme Court under God, because the majority certainly feels they're appropriate. But is that American?
I wonder, Lib, if you could tell us whether you think, I mean, I appreciate that you understand that some people have a problem saying under God because they don't believe in God. But I'm wondering what other emotions you feel about the flag.
Well, I'm very envious of my white friends who say that when they see it, it gives them goosebumps. I've never had that experience. I like it. I think it's beautiful, you know, artistically speaking. And it's, as I say, it is my flag. But I don't get the goosebumps that I think a lot of people do.
Carolyn, is that something that happens, that people look at the flag and don't feel the same? I mean, we don't all experience it the same way, certainly.
Well, I think if we use the model of the religion, you have some people who are more passionate believers than others. I'm very interested to hear Lib's story because, in fact, in 1916, there was an 11-year-old African-American child in Chicago who refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance because he was unhappy about Jim Crow laws and he did not perceive that he was he would salute the flag when the flag saluted him. And he was taken out of school and taken to juvenile court, and they couldn't find any statute that expressly required children to say the Pledge of Allegiance. So he was back in school. But there was also, during World War I, a kind of rumor that the Germans were fomenting unrest among black Americans who did not have the same rights as white Americans. So I would say that the flag is a place where communities notice that they're not included. I mean, that's a very visible sign of that lack of inclusiveness. And yet, somebody like Martin Luther King well understood, you know, that he could use that flag to appeal to the conscience of Americans.
I'm wondering, Lib, I want to thank you for your call. That was, it was very interesting. Whitney Smith, we are living in times and have done for, you know, for quite a while of real flag love. Have there ever been times in our history when that intensity didn't exist?
Absolutely. In the documentation that I've collected over the years, it's very clear that there are periods where, particularly the older population, will complain publicly. There'll be letters to the editor, editorials, all kinds of promotional movements in which they say, we've lost our love of the flag. And we know it in a particular setting, but you can see historically that this
when did that happen?
Well, for example, after the Spanish-American War, there were the lull of several decades before the First World War when we were accused of being unpatriotic, and after the First World War, before the Second, and again during the before the Vietnam War.
You mean, I'm sorry, I'm talking about eras when you know, this really overt love of flag.
Okay, those are the other periods. In other words, during the wars in particular, but also in terms of civil strife, the Vietnam War era, for example, you had the flag flown upside down by those who protested the war or with a peace symbol imposed on it, and others who were the hard hat riots in New York City, for example, who were promoting the flag. So it is, in a sense, a thermometer indicating the national passion over issues, not the flag itself. It's the question that we frame in terms of using the flag one way or the other.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Steve is calling from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi, Michael. It's definitely an interesting topic for me. I've always been interested in the history of the flag, and I remember as a child I used to collect the old circular flags and that flag that said 76 on it. And I remember that especially that the original 13-star flag always gave me a feeling of simplicity and unity that this nation was founded on. And it's interesting that, you know, as you sort of progress through the history of the flag, it's sort of morphed into a field. And, you know, for the vast majority of the 19th century and early part of the 20th century, sort of an incomplete field.
When you say field, you're referring to the upper blue corner?
Yes. Yeah, in the actual arrangement of the stars. Mm-hmm. And in 1912, when the 48-star flag was introduced, then we had sort of a complete field. And, you know, then briefly that was sort of rearranged again with a 59-star flag for half of the year. And then we came back to the complete field with the stars sort of splayed out. So it gives an air to me of sort of completeness and, you know, sort of the dominance of the United States, you know, so it's sort of taken on that characteristic to me.
Witness. And go ahead, Sue.
I beg your pardon?
Go ahead.
It fills me with really two emotions, the first of which are the principles on which this nation was founded, and the second is that we may have developed sort of a feeling of arrogance in that the principles on which we were founded are so important, they've given the United States greatness. Now, we need to be careful with that.
Okay, let me bring in Whitney Smith to just talk a bit about the filling out of the field as America expanded ocean to ocean.
It's a very complex story, and it is available in the books. What interests me is that there's the dichotomy between the flag as a sacred object, which we follow and salute and so forth, and then on the other hand, the flag is design. And the flag is design, you would think that people would simply accept, and yet there have been a tremendous number of people who have come up with new versions of the Stars and Stripes. They love the flag so much they want to change it. I've had the good fortune, I designed the national flag of Guyana and several other countries, so I know something about it professionally. But these people, it is just a sense their Americanism wants them to help the country improve the flag.
Well, when you sit down to design a flag like the national flag of Guyana, what is it that you ask? I mean, what does the client bring to you, and what are the specs on the
job?
Well,
the question of getting a commission, it's almost impossible in a foreign country, and that's why the Iraqi flag didn't work, because they went outside Iraq. I was in contact with the then premier of the country, Chetty Jagan, and they wanted something that would express their transition from a colonial status to an independent country, and they wanted something that would express what that country was. Well, I was at the time working in third world studies at Boston University, and was able to, on the basis of my reading and contacts with people, in a sense, psych out what might go into the flag, and then to find the design elements that would convey that. The average Guyanese would know better than I what should go in, but they tend, in every country, not just Guyana, to put in everything, including the kitchen sink. So it's a conversion. It's almost like writing a speech and then having a professional come in and cut it right to the core. The design should reflect the symbols, not represent them.
Okay, we're coming to the end of the segment. Just quickly describe for the listeners what the flag of Guyana that you designed.
First of all, it has a golden triangle on it because they wanted to thrust forward into the golden future based in part on the gold mines there. It has a red triangle because the triangle is a symbol of steadfastness geometrically and building a bridge, for example, and a green field because most of the country is the fields and forests. And they call it the golden arrowhead. Flag.
That's very, very interesting. Connection listeners, we're talking about flags, mostly about the American flag, because it's Flag Day today. We're talking about this remarkable subject. Flags are all around us. You know, we pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, but in Boston, where I am, there's plenty of bedroom walls where children pledge allegiance to the Boston Red Sox. They don't always win. They never win. And you know, flags are the symbols of what we love. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, the number to call to join in the conversation. And we'll be back right after this break. I'm Michael Goldfarb. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour, listeners, about flags on Flag Day. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. The number to call. Ernie is calling from Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Hi. I served in World War II, but I want to tell you that I think all national flags are abominations. I think they nationalism crystallizes around them. I think in this country, jingoism is rampant, especially now where you can't go to any event at all before the flag is waved. And I think it just intensifies the trend toward wars. And I think the linkage to religion is very significant because I think religions have caused more wars than anything else in the world since it's going back through history. I know it's a hopeless wish that national flags as emblems would be discarded, but that's what I would hope for.
Okay, Ernie, thanks for that comment. Carolyn Marvin?
Well, you know, I think Ernie is right to say that what's ineradicable here is not flags themselves, but the fact that groups we don't live by ourselves, we live in groups, and the survival of groups occasionally requires that blood be shed, groups compete, and then you have to convince yourself as a group both that it's justifiable to kill other people and that it's justifiable to kill members of your own group in defense of the group. And those are the very complicated tribal emotions that flags represent, and that's why it's so that's why they're so emotionally laden.
Whitney?
If we didn't have flags, we would have flag surrogates, I'm sure. And there have been societies where that's the case. It's very interesting following when the process of vexillification, of acquiring a flag, happened. In many parts of Africa, in many parts of Central Asia and the New World, there were societies that didn't have flags, but that doesn't mean that they didn't have things that bonded them.
Well, for example?
Well, you have scarification. At a certain age, people will become part of a clan or part of a group. You have sacrifice. Live human beings being killed. You have hairdos. You have ways of identifying the members by their color of their skin. So there are.
And you place all of these things, scarification, various rituals you go through, pass into adolescence, from adolescence into adulthood, as actually being, in a sense, from the same motivation that, you know, allows us to invest in the stars and stripes. A certain sense of belonging to that.
That is part of it. It's not the whole thing for flags. They have many functions, and these other things do as well. But if you were to take flags away, there was a time when national flags didn't exist, for example. People still found ways to communicate to other groups and individuals what it was they were attached to.
What is the earliest national flag?
Defined as we who have studied the question have done, the continental colors, or what is sometimes called the Grand Union, which was 13 red and white stripes and the British Union Jack in the corner, was the first national flag because it was the first flag chosen by the people rather than the king or the government and used to represent the people. There are other flags that had somewhat of that. The Netherlands, for example, in their 80 years war against Spain for independence. But I think there's general agreement that the real national flag of the modern type is new.
It's new. So that the nation state, as we mean it in the modern sense, which is several hundred years old only, nevertheless, it had existed for some time before 1776.
But what happened in the earlier time is, note in France, for example, it was he was the king of France. After the revolution, he was the king of the French. The idea of nationality, the king in his prerogative could sell, could barter away, could give as a dowry, could do anything he wanted with the territory, and the people had no say in it. After nationalism, that was ended.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Khalsa is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Good morning, actually. Yes, I'm calling about a couple of things and comments. The last caller, a World War II veteran, who I would very much have to say we should respect his comments because he served in a time when there was a united nation under one banner. But this jingoism that he speaks about, this fanaticism, this making the American flag a religious symbol, has been around probably since the Civil War, in my opinion. Your historians will be able to verify that. But it seems that originally the American flag, the one that was first transitioned from the Grand Union flag, is a Masonic symbol. And I'm saying that because the number 13 is in all the symbols of our nation, in our logos, in our
Khalsa, hang on to your thought, because you've got a couple of questions there. Let me, first of all, because Whitney was shaking his head when you asserted Masonic intentions to the design of the flag. Whitney?
We know there were 13 colonies. The 13 stars were for the colonies. If it has in some way association with Masonry, it's not reflected in the history of the flag.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Sally is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi.
I think when you asked the more personal question, what the flag means to you, I realized that there was a sadness that it has become associated with more right-wing politics, even before 9/11 and after 9/11, if you did not have a flag lapel, if you weren't wearing something to do with the flag, you were considered non-patriotic. And so I felt a sadness when I haven't heard this whole discussion. I've just come into it late. But that was just my deep personal feeling, that even having traveled all over the world, when I come to this country, I don't know how I could have any stronger patriotic feeling. So my sadness is that it has been connected in some way with almost a...
What you're really saying, Sally, is that it's been appropriated by conservatives, I think.
Right.
Stay with us. Stay with us, Sally, because I want to come back to you. Carolyn, has this happened before? I mean, I think that that's not an uncommon perception, and that affects the way people view the flag.
Absolutely. The only thing I would say about the word appropriation is that the flag really does belong to all of us, and there is no reason that people who feel differently than the right wing, if that's the opposition that somebody has, can't go out and wave the flag for their side of the issue as well. I mean, it is not that's simply a refusal, I think, of people to say, look, I am a patriotic person. I believe in the flag, and here are my values. And I don't think these other folks are responding to my values. So it's not as though the flag has a fixed meaning. It really is the meaning that everyone appropriates for themselves and their friends. So I don't see this as anything that is permanent. I would say that the sort of real first thrust of this real deep patriotic connection to the flag really comes after the Civil War at the turn of the century, because a couple of things are going on. First of all, the Civil War veterans are dying out. And, you know, this was a huge rupture in the country's life, the Civil War, and we can't lose that covenant and so forth. And so the veterans groups who are passing from the scene get very, very concerned about this. And at the same time, there is an absolutely huge influx of immigration and a challenge in that way to American identity. So there's a lot of anxiety in that period also about whether or not these new Americans will assimilate properly. And so the flag moves into the schools with the help of these patriotic groups, these voluntary patriotic groups, who very much want the Pledge of Allegiance. It is part of this period, Flag Day, all of these kinds of ceremonies that we now think of as wholly traditional and having been there forever really begin in this period after the Civil War. That was a real patriotic time because of the fears that the country might be coming undone again.
Whitney, this notion that one group appropriates the flag and makes it a symbol for them and is successful enough in its actions to alienate other parts of American society, has that happened before?
Yes. There were, for example, before the Civil War, versions of the Stars and Stripes that were made in which stars and sometimes even stripes were omitted. And in the North, when that was done, it was abolitionists who were saying, if we have slavery, then we have, in a sense, gone back on the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and so we have to have a pure country, only a free states. And it was done in the South as well. And there have been the suffragettes had flags in which they put in only as many stars as there were states that recognized female suffrage. So that modification of the flag in one way or another, or trying to say we are the ones that it really represents, has gone on probably for at least 150 years.
Sally, I want to thank you for that thought-provoking call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Bill is on the line from Burlington, Vermont.
Yes, hello.
Hey, Bill.
I was just curious what your guests feel regarding the attempt to make an amendment barring the burning of the American flag as a political statement versus the use of the flag as underwear for people, rock star using it at halftime at the Super Bowl, cutting it and wearing it as a poncho, and why people feel as strongly as they do about somebody.
Okay, that's a good question. Let me put it to both Whitney and Carolyn. Whitney first.
One of the things we talked about appropriation that is implicit in this amendment is the ability of the states to bring back the laws that were declared unconstitutional. We know, although those flag desecration laws originally were drafted to protect against commercial exploitation. In fact, the court cases, very clearly documented, are all about persecuting unpopular political views. And so I would see that personally as a tragedy, because it really puts the definition almost permanently in the hands of those who say we are the only ones who can define the flag.
Carolyn?
I agree completely. I think the flag is for waving. The flag is for burning. The flag is for making a different number of stars because it represents the states that let women vote. I mean, I think that is the purpose of the flag, for the community to talk to itself about what a sort of community it is. And I think the sturdiness of the flag is quite clear. It has endured. And these are simply, we are saying, you know, our community should be something besides what it is, and I'm going to do something with the flag to indicate that. Now, part of this business is this, that we've really got two flags, and one is this really aloof, sacred flag, the one that's in all the ceremonies of state, the one that is behind the president when he speaks, and this kind of thing. And then we've got the popular flag, and this is the flag that the people appropriate for themselves, and they make clothes out of it, and they joke with it, and they do all these things, and that doesn't mean that they don't feel affectionately towards
Carolyn,
it and reverently towards it.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're coming to the end of the show, and we've got time for one last call. Joe from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Yes, okay. Like I stated earlier, I consider the flag something like family. We all have family, and we know that our family, when we have family reunion, there are some people in there that we really cannot get along with. But still, when something come up, we stand together as a family. Well, I consider the flag the same way. Someone spoke earlier about united under the flag during World War II, but you got to realize that even during World War II, the blacks, I am blacks, were not accepted in the armed forces. They were not accepted as flyers. That's why you had the Tuskegee experiment. The Japanese American wasn't accepted. The German American wasn't accepted. But this is all under the flag. When we were united, I think when we talk about the flag, we must consider things in reality and accept, yes, it is a symbol, just like a barrel of apples. They look good. But once we start digging, we find the parts that will more or less spoil the whole barrel if we leave them in there.
All right, Joe, I want to thank you for that final thought on Flag Day. And I also want to thank my guests, Carolyn Marvin, Professor of Communications at the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania. She was speaking to us from Philadelphia. Thank you, Carolyn. And Whitney Smith, Director of the Flag Research Center in Winchester, Massachusetts. Dr. Smith is the author of 26 different books on flags, and he's the man who coined the term for the study of flags, vexillology. It's not necessarily a vexed subject, though, when I'm talking about it with you, Whitney Smith. Thank you very much for joining us. You're a high-flying flag, yes. Okay. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.
Every heart beats blue on the red, white, and blue, where the devil abode.